Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We have around 6,000 members worldwide and around 50 branches. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 10th of July, 2023, and this is episode 308. On today's Dispatches podcast, I talked to historian, teacher and researcher Caroline Terode about her research into state teachers from Victoria in Australia during the First World War. She spoke to me from her office in Victoria, Australia. Caroline, welcome to the Dispatches podcast. May you start by introducing yourself and telling us how you became interested in the Great War, and in particular, Victorian government school teachers and their officer promotions.
Thank you very much, Tom, for inviting me to be part of your podcast. It's actually a privilege to be a part of this podcast. Just to introduce myself, my name's Caroline Terode. I'm a history teacher and also a historian. One of the wonderful things about history, I find, is, and both, you know, writing, studying and teaching history, is how it can be conveyed through the means of storytelling. So within my own story, there's a little bit of a background for me to be able to get to this point, to be able to talk about Victorian government teachers and the AIF officer selection and promotions during the Great War. So I have a bit of an interest in the First World War for a number of reasons. Going back to my childhood and so forth, I grew up in a household surrounded by war magazines and aircraft magazines and documentaries about the Second World War. And I think back and, you know, I think about my father and his father's military service during the Second World War and the trauma associated with, you know, military service as well, and how my dad was probably trying to make sense of my grandfather's military service by finding out more and having all these things littered around the house. And then we went on Sunday drives around country Victoria. So country Victoria is actually quite big, and, you know, it takes us 3 hours to get to a place called Bendigo, and, you know, having lunch up there and, you know, looking at war memorials and the Chinese museums and, you know, dad showing our family properties and so forth. So, you know, just as a child, I was exposed to those things. And so I'm actually quite appreciative and quite thankful. So then from there, I went off to university. I've always wanted to be a school teacher. Studied a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Teaching combined. And it was after the first semester, first year, where I failed psychology, that I actually decided, I think I better, you know, choose something else that I'm actually interested in. And I chose to major in history, and my sub-majors in geography. So then after finishing university, well, actually while I was studying university, studied a little bit of military history under Joan Beaumont, who is now over at ANU, Professor Emerita. And she's written, you know, books like Broken Nation and so forth. So I've had a little bit of an interest, even though I've, you know, had a bit of a history background in colonial history. But then as a school teacher, and I've been working in Victorian government schools for now 23 years, and the Victorian school curriculum is actually heavily militarised. So I'll be teaching World War One history to year 9, Second World War to year 10s. When I get to year 11 and year 12, it's a world history, 20th century history. Again, coming back to, we've got things about the end of the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, the Paris Peace Agreement, leading up to the rise of Hitler and Nazi Germany. So it's always there in the back of my mind, you know, World War One and then World War Two. And then for me, probably personally, was then travelling to the Western Front in 2012. And there were two places along the Western Front that really stood out for me. One was Essex Farm, the Essex Farm Cemetery, where many of your listeners have probably been to, know the story about John McRae and the dressing stations that are there. And just seeing Great Britain's 8th Battalion Rifles, the Rifle Brigade, a number of them just row by row had actually died about in 1916, 1917, on my birthday, about 62 years beforehand. I'm going, oh my God, this is, something that, these men, 62 years before were alive and they've died in these dressing stations. And that really hit home for me. Is that was one place. The other place was visiting the Victoria School in Villers-Bretonneux. And again, coming back to most Australians are aware of Villers-Bretonneux. Your listeners coming from places around the United Kingdom, well, obviously here in Australia as well, United States, may not be as familiar with the connection that Australia has to Villers-Bretonneux, particularly Victorian school children and Victorian school teachers. So have a bit of an interest in education history as well. So I visited the Victoria School the day after Anzac Day. So the original school in town was destroyed during the British and German action on the 25th and the 26th, the 25th, 24th, 25th of April 1918. And the Germans would win and occupy the township, only to be met by two Australian brigades in a counter-attack. So after the war, this is a real thing for me. Australian school children, particularly Victorian school children, raised around about the equivalent to about 2 million Australian dollars, so about 22,000 pounds. Victorian school children raised about 11,000 of that 22,000 pounds. So they raised roughly about 1.12 million through fundraising, which I'd like to touch on a little bit later when we get more into this. So, just visiting the Victoria School, standing there, then going into the museum space, and then also going into the quadrangle and actually seeing that this school in the middle, in this little part of France, in the Somme, and they actually have in the quadrangle, "Do not forget Australia." And there's Australian flags. They teach the Victorian, curriculum. They teach the Victorian state way of how we of writing and seeing footballs and all sorts of things. Actually, for me, I go, oh, I need to actually find a bit more about, about the Great War itself. So then, do a little bit of work. I actually enroll into a university program. I complete a graduate certificate in World Historical Studies to get myself into my current master's degree program. So I'm studying a Master of War Studies at the University of New South Wales, Canberra, at the Australian Defence Force Academy. And then from there, I've been able to get into their research thesis program last year. And then when thinking about a topic, and I was discussing this with my supervisor, Dr. David Stahl, and Professor Peter Stanley, I'm going, I'm interested in Victorian, government teachers. I'm interested in the Victoria School. I'm interested in the story and so forth. And it came down to what is it that I wanted to focus on? And I'm sort of like thinking, well, looking at books like the Department of Education's War Service record from 1914 to 1919, I wanted to work out why so many Victorian state school teachers, or government teachers more specifically, and I'm thinking of people like, VC recipient Frank McNamara, Brigadier General Walter Ramsay MacNicoll, and even, another Brigadier General as well, Carl Herman Jess. Why so many of these men, and there were 700 and, over 771 of them, were able to achieve such rank and position, and then also looking at what awards they also had received as well. And then we were able to narrow down from there to the actual officer promotion process, as to why these Victorian government teachers were selected for officer selection. So it's a bit of a story there. Bit of a story there, but it's taken me the best part since graduating from university, as I said, 23 years to actually get to this point, and I'm really excited to this is only just the beginning. I'd like to think this is just the beginning of something that I can get myself right into and find out a lot more about, and actually bring this back, not only at a military level, or military history level, but also at a school, state education level in here in Victoria as well, and actually bring this back into the classroom and actually try and understand why, and promote also why is to about the history of, I call them our teacher ancestors, and the role that our teacher ancestors had in the war effort here in Victoria and working with our students as well.
And talking of awards, you were one of the WFA's Master's Grant Scheme Award for 2022. I said got that all a bit wrong, but essentially, you were doing a master's. You were given a grant by the WFA as part of a scheme that the WFA runs. Can you tell us about how this has helped your research?
Very lucky living here in Australia that most of our archival records for World War One are accessible free. So we have a wonderful institution called National Archives Australia, and the series that I was looking at was the B2455 series, which is the service records for Australian soldiers. So I was able to access those free. We also have another, wonderful website called Trove that links with newspaper articles going back to the 1800s. So again, that was free. What I was able to use the Western Front Association Master's Grant, and I'm ever so thankful for this and being able to have the opportunity to be a recipient and also give back to the Western Front Association. So it did pay for some records that I did need to access, so in particular repatriation records that have not been digitized. So there was a couple of records that I needed to get that way. But it's also more specifically textbooks and specific books that I needed to get. So things like Will Westerman Soldiers and Gentlemen, which was actually about officers, the officers during World War One and beyond. Dale Blair's Dink and Diggers, which I'll refer to a little bit later on as well, which was a case study or a similar statistical analysis into the 1st Battalion as well, and that was actually quite a handy resource to have. And then books such as, and this is one of the biggest ones for me, was Rosalie Triolo's Our Schools in the War. And Rosalie Triolo, if you ever get to speak to her, she's a wonderful education historian. And both her and I have been able to swap ideas and being able to discuss about the role of Victorian government teachers during the First World War. She looks at it from more of an education history or educational history, which I tend to look at a little bit myself as well, but then also I bring in the military aspect too. So it's those resources that have been able to help me, because otherwise I probably would not have been able to get a hold of some of them myself.
Right, well, let's get on to what you did look at. Now, I think probably just something just to clarify issues before we go further. You live in the state of Victoria, which is one of the states of Australia, and obviously Melbourne is where you're speaking from. And also, you talk about Victorian teachers, and for me, I've been confused assuming that they are teachers of the Victorian era. So when we're talking about Victorian teachers, we are talking about teachers from the state of Victoria. That's just to clarify my sort of challenge. So if people wonder why we're talking about Victorian teachers, they are from the state of Victoria.
Yes. So not talking about the Victorian era or the Edwardian era or anything like that. It's Victorian, the Victorian state. Yes, you're right, Tom.
Right. Now, from an initial list of 771 Victorian government teacher soldiers, your study looks at a final cohort of 18 officers who served in the Australian Imperial Force and were also employed in Victorian government schools before and during the Great War. Can you tell us about this group and what their social, economic, and ethnic backgrounds were?
So actually pretty interesting because narrowing down from 771, I was able to bring down to a final, not a necessarily final cohort, it was a second final cohort of about 64, and then from there, so it was a range of teaching staff. So the original 771 were education staff as well, office staff, people who worked in the department at a government level. And what I specifically wanted were the teachers. So I've gone from the 771 education office staff, education teachers, etc. And then I've gone to 64 of teachers. And then I've gone to 18 officers from that list of 64. So really from there, when I get to the 64, it is a valid statistical sample. Getting to the 18, however, It's actually, I sometimes, even though I've been told it is a valid sample, I sometimes go, I probably would have liked to have explored a bigger cohort than rather just 18 officers or 18 teacher officers, as I call them. So, in looking at them, looking at their attributes, I have, as I've mentioned, I've gone into the National Archives Australia, looked at the B245 series records. Most of them were from that sample born in Victoria, in Melbourne, Melbourne the city itself, and Melbourne the city itself then back in 1914, 1915 is a lot smaller than what Melbourne today is. But they worked in rural schools. So they had that, you know, the city connection, but because of the nature of employment in schools at that time, if they went to a continuation school, and this is what I'll talk a little bit later on about education levels, they were often placed at a rural school. If they were, you know, lived in a rural area, quite often how teachers or how, you know, students became teachers, they might have become a monitor and then they've worked their way, you know, in a school, worked as become a junior teacher, and then they've gone to a continuation school and so forth. But the sample itself, most of the teachers came from Melbourne, the city. Thinking about socioeconomic status, teachers even now, because of education levels and also because of even back in 1914, 1918, they were salaried workers. So it wasn't the itinerant workers that we see in country towns. They had a stable job, and they had a reasonable level of education as well. When we're looking at the average age of an Australian finishing school at the age of 12, many of these teachers had an education of around about 15 years of age and above, somewhere at university as well. So when I think about the, and again coming back, I'll talk to about reasons for in enlisting into the AIF, but thinking about that, the salaried workers' pay would not necessarily have been a reason for them to join the AIF. I just can't prove that at this stage. I tried searching for salaries of the government system at that particular time, and I haven't been able to establish that particular point. But my feeling is that, you know, pay was not a reason for their enlistment, so because of their salary. So, predominantly Protestant religion. Also, there are primarily primary school teachers, and this is why I use the phrase Victorian government teachers instead of the phrase Victorian state teachers. So I'm employed as a state education teacher. I work as a secondary teacher. I'm actually a high school teacher. So I'm teaching students from the age of 12 right through to 17, 18. That's in the current modern context as a state education. If I go back to the period of the Great War, state educate or state schools were primary schools, grades one to about which grade one to about year seven, year eight. And then we've also got the establishment of other the higher secondaries during that period. So we've got the establishment of the higher elementary system, technical schools, and high schools. However, most of the teachers working in the system were state school teachers, the primary school teachers. Another feature probably was that they were more likely, these government teachers more likely to enlist during the July, August 1915 period. And this links to the Victoria, the state, the move to actually increase or push recruitment into the AIF, because it was seen at that point that Victoria was lagging behind, Victoria wasn't doing its bit. So let's actually, you know, show the other states what Victoria can do. So we see quite a fair few actually enlist during those 2 months. I think of Melbourne Town Hall, for example, being open till 10 o'clock at night, bands playing, demonstrations out the front, and actually trying to get men to enlist. And these men having that connection to Melbourne, coming into Melbourne and actually enlisting at Melbourne Town Hall. It's mentioned about the above average education. So they would have had an education level of at least a continuation school of, so that's about 15, 16, 7 years of age, specialising as or becoming a qualified teacher. There's two in the sample, in the entire sample, that had some university subjects. and it was generally physics and maths, and one had, I think, an English subject from memory as well. But it wasn't until they hadn't completed university, and it wasn't until after the war, if they had returned, that they had the option to actually go into university as well. So probably the last few significant things was about the age of teachers enlisting into the AIF. So we're looking at a relatively young for AIF force, the average age being about 21, 22 years of age. The average Victorian government teacher was about 28 years when they're actually promoted. So they were older at enlistment, but then also when we get into the Office of Promotions, they were younger. So the average officer in the AIF at the start of the war was about 40 years of age. Then it drops down, possibly because of the nature of the war of attrition, needing to replace, officers with more soldiers. So the age comes down. And by around about 1916, 1917, actually 1918, to be honest with you, it had declined to about 31 years of age. If I look at Victorian government teachers in this instance, the average age when they're actually promoted to be an officer was about 28 years and 6 months. So they were younger than their other counterparts at promotion, but older at enlistment. So it's probably some of the things that my study picks up, which is quite interesting. Quite interesting.
So, do we know why this group volunteered to enlist to fight? Obviously, we've got to remember that Australia operates a largely, in fact, completely volunteer force throughout the war. So, I'm going to start that question again. So let's look at this group. Now, do we know why they volunteered to enlist, and how did they compare to the wider workforce of Victorian government employees within the school system within the state?
So, as many of your listeners would be aware, that Australians had, like any other member of the Allied forces, many Australian men had varying reasons to enlist into the AIF. They obviously wanted to do their bit. They wanted to serve the Empire. They also wanted to experience travel and adventure. As I mentioned before about the itinerant nature of employment in some aspects of Australian society, and then, if I'm going to use the phrase, the constraints of a Victorian Edwardian era as well, that the enticement of the, or the excitement of travel and venture, enticed men into the AIF, or even some men just wanted to leave, relationships and or receive a higher pay. Victorian government teachers, on the other hand, I mean, they all had their own personal reasons for enlisting, but there are other influences that may have contributed to their reasons for enlistment that other professions or other individuals may not have had. So I think about, the idea of patriotism, probably being the biggest one, and how that was filtered into the Victorian schools, the school system itself. Okay. So, I think about the publication of the school paper. I think of the War Relief Organisation. This is the organisation that helped raise the $11,500 at the end of the war to build the Victoria School. I think of the establishment of that. I think of the publication of the school paper, the Education Gazette. I think of commemoration in state schools themselves and high schools and tech schools. So, and how these teachers would have been exposed to that. And having to see in an Education Gazette or the school paper, pictures of colleagues, who have died on active service and who have done their bit and so forth. But So I think about the War Relief Organisation itself. So at the declaration of war in August 1914, the Victorian Director of Education, Frank Tait, actually engaged the education department and established the War Relief Organisation. It made government schools to undertake fundraising activities by whatever means, including public demonstrations such as how to preserve fruit, or what's the show off the cornucopia of harvest and so forth. The collection of specific items such as buttons, and also even in schools with woodwork as well. And there's one documented example that I can briefly talk about woodwork teachers actually getting their students to make splints and sending them off to the Western Front, or to, over to Gallipoli. And there's one documented case where, you know, a doctor in along the Western Front actually pulls out this splint. It's got the name of the student on it and who's actually made it and what the school was as well. So there was all these things of fundraising happening because teachers in there, by nature, we get involved in our communities and by whatever means. So I know myself as to what I do and how I get involved. Just the other night I was actually doing a school tour with a group of parents that, you know, possibly coming to our school for to our school next year. And these blokes would have done the same things. And they would have been also not only, you know, doing the information nights and you know, they would also be getting involved in their local community during the weekend as well, and you know, doing things like coaching football or even military cadets as well. So there's that aspect to it. So then on top of the War Relief Organisation, the Department of Education created clubs such as the Young Workers Patriotic Guild and the League of Young Gardeners, encouraging school children to take a bit of a plot of their family land and, you know, grow vegetables, sell the vegetables and the plants and donate the money to the War Relief Organisation effort. And then we've also the last two things, whether they're propaganda or not, I don't know how to explain this, but the publication, the monthly publication of the school paper, which was used in schools as a teaching tool. So every student was required to purchase the school paper and read it at home. Every teacher was required to use it in the classroom. Every student, every teacher could be asked, you know, by an inspector as well, you know, whether or not what was in the current issue. And it had a lot of patriotic sentiment and poems, letters from the front, you know, as I mentioned earlier, and this crosses over with the Education Gazette as well. Images of, you know, teachers' profiles and so forth, or even stories that come back from the front as well. And the last one, or last two, is the Education Gazette, which is the monthly, again, monthly publication given to every single school, every single teacher. And that was more about the directions, the departmental directions that schools were to implement. And even simple things, which links to my next idea, is about the installment of honour boards into schools and what they should look like, what their measurements should be, where they should be placed and located. And I think also, again, to my own high school, I went to Essendon High School, and my high school was established in 1913, just shortly before the war. And they're one of the first high schools in Victoria. So we're thinking of state schools being primary, grade one to grade eight, and high schools were beyond, you know, probably grade seven through to matriculation, which is current year 12. And my school was one of the first in the state to be established. And I can remember just looking almost every week at the assembly, in the hall, and looking at that honour board, and you know, these things that they were placed above, not at eye level, but above eye level, just giving us some sort of indication that, you know, there's more things that are more above us as well. So, you know, Victorian government teachers themselves would have been influenced by or encouraged, at least at an employment level, with all of those things, and also in the personal level, all the other factors as well that we have acknowledged, that other Australian men, the reasons for their enlistment.
So let's look at their promotions. Now, obviously, they were all commissioned. What rank did they achieve? And can you sort of tell us how they were commissioned? Were they commissioned from the ranks, or were they given sort of direct commissions based on their education, or did they achieve their sort of officer status in another way?
So from the sample itself, so as mentioned, 18 in the final sample received commissions. So we're looking at 15 lieutenants and three captains. So in the AIF itself, there were four methods of commissioning. So those who were officers prior to the war, those who were in the graduating classes of Duntroon, which is the military college similar to Sandhurst, and that's located in Canberra, and my university is actually next door to that. And then we've got individuals who demonstrate the traits and specialist skills the AIF desired. And then we've got the last one, promotions of the NCOs through the ranks, and whether that be attritional or whatever. So within that itself, we're probably looking at one teacher who was an officer prior to the war. We don't have any teachers within my sample who were in any graduating classes of Duntroon. There were 16, however, that demonstrate the traits and specialist skills of the that the AIF desired, and one that was an NCO and that was promoted through the ranks, and he was actually asked to apply for a commission. So, in this instance, of those 16, well, actually probably 17, so the 16 that demonstrated the specialist skills and traits the AIF desired, and the NCO who was probably tapped on the shoulder, there's a general perception that battlefield commissions existed for AIF soldiers, and in this instance, that perception holds true. So, these men actually had proven themselves in battle, and then we can see there, I've even broken it down a bit further. 13 of those men have received battlefield commissions, 13 of those, and then four had applied for commissions at enlistment. One was successful in becoming an officer, as he was an officer prior to the war, and then one, as I mentioned, one applied for a commission during his time, and he was an NCO for a period of time. So then it can be asserted that many of the teacher officers were promoted through the NCO ranks and then proven their leadership skills, whether it be through, one of the things that the AIF were looking for was obviously white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males who held higher than average education levels. And if I have a look back at the examination questions for Duntroon, specifically in 1914, you can see there that the level of literacy required it was quite high. We also see as well, what is the role of an officer? The role of an officer is to read and interpret his commanding officer's directions. So if you can't read and understand your commanding officer's directions, how are you going to actually lead your men as well? So, the higher than average literacy and numeracy levels, and that's shown through the education, going on to the continuation school, going on to university, and working as teachers as well.
And were Victorian government school teachers a group that were disproportionately represented in the AIF officer corps?
Thank you. That's actually really an interesting question, Tom, because I don't have an answer for that. I would love to be able to answer it. So there's been a number of studies that have been undertaken about the characteristics and attributes of AIF officers and the AIF Corps itself. So I think back to Leslie Lloyd Robson back in the 1970s. I think of Dale Blair in the 1st Battalion, that was the early 2000s. And we've got Jean Beau and Peter Dennis in recent years. And each of them have just looked at the cohort of men. They actually haven't drilled down to individual professions. So, until some sort of further study is undertaken comparing the employment of or the professions of AIF officers, so say for example, my study, we're looking at government teachers and actually comparing that to engineers or bankers or doctors or lawyers, it's actually quite hard to be able to ascertain whether or not they're disproportionately represented in the AIF Corps.
But do you think there was anything special about the 18 men that you looked at, maybe teachers in general, that made them useful or effective officers?
Probably a little bit about the social status as well. As mentioned earlier, they're white collar workers. They work with people in the community. They have good communication skills. They're well educated. Probably, I think about the education levels in particular certainly help. And I think about, official war historian Charles Bean in particular. And there's a number of things in a number of his volumes of the Official History of Australia War. He actually likens the work of an officer to that of a teacher. And he actually says, he actually mentions, Carl Herman Jess, for example, was a former school teacher, and he's able to keep his men in line and so forth. But it's the maintaining of discipline, it's the development of curriculum, it's the interpretation of orders as well that Bean talks about in his official history, where he's able to make that link between teachers and the role of an AIF officer, and those education levels certainly would have helped as well. So I think really in a number of ways, if we're looking at battlefield commissions, probably many were probably in the right place at the right time. They were promoted in the field rather than an enlistment. They did show some of the desirable traits that and attributes the AIF wanted officers. So, like I've mentioned previously, most of them were men who were came from Melbourne, but they were living in the bush. That was one thing that the AIF wanted. They wanted, predominantly Protestant officers as well. Thinking about the nature of the Protestant and Catholic debates in society, Australian society at that point. Or divisions in Australian society at that point. The education levels, again, and it's also whether, I mean, it doesn't even come down to whether or not these men were married or not as well. So they wanted, men to lead men as well. So if you chart and track their NCO promotions prior to commissioning, many commissioned in the field held multiple extra duties pay or EDP positions or temporary positions. In addition, I always question, on top of those extra duties pay positions, whether or not just because these men showed an eagerness as to whether or not they were tapped on the shoulder for appointment as well. So you've got the desire, the desired skills, but then you've got the eagerness and actually putting their hand up for odd jobs. And then we've also got things such as the war of attrition itself, and whether, the need to quickly replace officers as well would have contributed to as to why these men were quickly promoted. So I couldn't pursue that further of that line of inquiry, thinking about the war of attrition, because of the space that I had within my thesis itself. But it could be something that could be easily correlated. And correlating the dates of commissioning and appointments against major Australian engagements, for example, and seeing, whether or not that was something as to why men were promoted. And then lastly, probably men were promoted for their pre-war experiences. So I didn't mention, I should have mentioned earlier that one of the other things in Victorian schools prior to the First World War was the heavy militarisation of the curriculum. Not only was, taught in classrooms, but we had a cadet program that started back in the 1880s, and that was a where teachers were able to take on cadet training, a cadet corps, as part of, to assist the colonial force. And they actually took on things such as a military drill certificate as well, and most of the men actually chose that military drill certificate, for the extra pay that it gave them, and maybe, sort of like that perception of authority in the classroom. But also after, we see about Federation, the Australian Federation in 1901, and the establishment of the Commonwealth Forces, that we still have the cadet program here in Victoria, but then we have the introduction of the Universal Training Scheme in 1909. So, and that was the introduction of junior and senior cadets, and all men, all boys over a particular age going into the cadet program in preparation for a possible war. So a lot of these teachers actually got involved into that, and I think of one in particular, Wilfred Barlow Griffith, for example. So he was the one that was commissioned at enlistment in my sample because of his prior war experiences. So he was a company commander in the junior and senior cadets and also in the citizens forces. He passed the officer school training certificates, had passed the education qualifications for several subjects, including physics and chemistry. And then he was also a chief instructor of NCOs and physical training schools. So many of these roles and experiences, he had this massive list in his service record file, because on the attestation paper itself, what is your previous military experience? And you've got about three tiny little lines. He actually attached a foolscap piece of paper with his military experience on it. So he was able to gain a commission on the basis of that prior military experience. But also with little quirks that were there as well for teachers that allowed, if you're a commander or an officer in the citizens' military forces, that allowed for, as long as you pass the certificate or the examination to be able to become an automatic AIF officer. And that can all that type of stuff can be directly linked to his employment as a.
So what happened to the 18 men that you looked at in the war? What was their fate?
So within my study, 66.67%, very specific, or 12 teacher officers returned at the end of the war. The Victorian Education Department itself supported the return of teachers back into the classroom. They did things like retraining, they provided additional courses, priority in employment, extra payments to families of those who killed. So with that, only, I think from memory, six of those 12 went back into the classroom, or at least back into the government system. There were two that went on to the private register, and that would have meant they'd gone into a private school. So, and then from the sample itself, the highest rank achieved was a captain. So three from the sample. So we've got James Douglas Haddo from Sale High School, James Arthur Landham from Middle Park State School, which is the primary school, and Norman Gilbert Pelton from North Melbourne State School rose to the rank of captain. And then from even there, within the sample, we've got six receiving the Military Cross, we've got one receiving a military medal, and then from there we've also got one captain, Norman Pelton, the one from North Melbourne State School, and four lieutenants were killed in action. So the one come back to Wilford Griffith, sorry, Barlow Griffith, he was a lieutenant, and he was what I was just mentioning about, the massive list of prior military experience. So he was from Watchham State School, which was Country Victoria. He was killed at Bullecourt, on the 12th of May 1917. And one of the things that really grabbed me was the letter that his commanding officer wrote to his widow in the months after his death. And I'll just read this to you, Tom. And sorry if I, talk a little bit too fast to your listeners as well. So his commanding officer, the head of the 58th Battalion, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Denenhay, writes to his widow, writes to Griffith's widow, "I lost many good men that 12th of May, and as report after report was brought to me from different parts of the line that this officer and that had been put out of action. Lieutenant Barlow came to me and said, 'I'm not wanted at headquarters now, sir. Let me go and take one of the leaderless battalions.' I gave him permission to go, and it was not 10 minutes before he was killed. His was the supreme sacrifice, putting aside all thought of personal danger so he might serve his regiment in its bitter struggle. It's the spirit of men like him that won the day and gained for the 58th a splendid victory that will live in the history of the AIF." So I think about men like him, and he wasn't recently commissioned, been an officer for about a year or so at that point. But ch again, Charles Bean, the official war historian, actually mentions how men newly given their commissions, they were so eager, so willing to prove themselves in the battle, as particularly, second lieutenants as well, where it gave rise to the sort of phrase "one star, one stunt" as well. And I think of, Lieutenant Wilford Barlow Griffith, actual Griffith Barlow. I'll go back, Tom. Sorry, I forgot his name. I'm getting his mixed up. So it's Wilford Barlow Griffith. So I think of Charles Bean and what Charles Bean has said about newly minted men, commissioned men, how they want to be able to prove themselves in battle, and giving rise to the phrase "one star, one stunt." And I think of Wilford Barlow Griffith himself, and how he would have wanted to prove to his men about his leadership qualifications and his leadership skills and so.
And so, to our penultimate question, what does your study reveal about the AIF during the war?
So I think what my study confirms is probably a lot of the information about the skills and the attributes the AIF desired of its offers of its officers, and its officer selection and appointments. The thing is that the officer selection and appointment process evolved over the course of the Great War itself. So if I look at 1914 with the establishment of the AIF, and then we've got Major General William Bridges actually appointing his own people as officers, and whether it be people from England or Great Britain, I should say more specifically, bringing them over here to Australia, people from the graduating classes of Duntroon as well, or even those British officers who were here on secondment. So a lot of those men were appointed as officers initially. And the whole aim of the AIF officer selection process and appointment process, it wasn't codified. That's a problem. And that's been one of the biggest or the hardest things in trying to establish what that process was. And talking to a number of historians and other people researching this particular topic, those people haven't been able to establish that either. So it comes down to some vague sets of, of characteristics and like a phasing period of movement going from this Britocentric appointment process to a more egalitarian appointment where every Australian can have the opportunity to become an officer. So if I think about that, it was probably looking more at the characteristics itself. Then we're going towards, the establishment of the selection boards, at enlistment as well. So in the selection boards themselves were, you've got a commanding officer and you've got two civilian military officers on the board, and you've got men who are enlisting and putting in their application for commissions, and they've got a set of criteria. For example, an officer, could not be selected unless he was 23 years of age. That's just one thing. And so that actually problems with that particular model actually removed a lot of potential men. Also probably increased the possibility that men increased their ages at enlistment. There was one from my sample who was around about the 8 and a half when he first enlisted, tried to apply for a commission, didn't get it, but then he was promoted about 12 months later and became an officer. And on his enlistment paper, he actually his age as about 23. So he was really 20 years and 6 months when he received his commission. He was 19 and a bit when he was first enlisted, 20 years, 6 months. But I've been able to prove himself in battle and earn that, earn that commission. Whereas, and I sort of like think that he perhaps probably upped his age so that he could, show that he was eligible for a commission at the age of 23, even though he wasn't. That's one thing. And then we've also got, as mentioned before, about the Battlefield Commission as well. So, I mean, giving men, from any, this is one of the things, and talking with you earlier, Tom, that we like to think that the AIF was somewhat egalitarian in nature, and it was probably more democratic and egalitarian when compared to other armies, for example, especially at the British Army. But it still had its quirks, and it still had its prejudices as well. And and I think we can see that with my study in itself, in actually showing what those characteristics and what those.
And finally, where can people learn more about your study?
At this stage, I haven't published my paper yet. I'm looking at abridging my thesis itself into a journal article, hopefully for publication within the next 12, 18 months. So I still have 6 months of my coursework to complete at the Australian Defence Force Academy, and want to get that out of the way, get that finished, and then be able to work on the journal article, because I have been asked to consider to cons be to consider a PhD as well. So, which is pretty awesome. I'm pretty rapt about that. And I'm thinking I might actually take that on. Don't tell my supervisor yet. I'm waiting for him to listen to this podcast. So that would be one avenue, is actually seeing about a publication. And even if I can take this thesis itself into the PhD realm, but I have some varying social media. So I have an Instagram account, and I can give this or send this to you if you want to put it down in your socials feed. So it's I have a war memorial Instagram account. I take photos of war memorials, and people send me photos of war memorials as well. And I write a little bit about the history because I'm interested in I'm not really interested in the operational history of the First World War. I'm actually really interested in the social history of the First World War, particularly the Australian experience. So I'll load the car up, take the car out for a drive, or if I need to go up to the university and I'm stopping along the way, taking photos of war memorials and posting them to my Instagram account. So that's Torodes underscore war memorial. So it's Torodeys underscore war underscore memorials. And then I have a Facebook page as well, which is Caroline Torode Historian. And then if your listeners would love to contact me and find out more, and I'm more than willing to talk to anybody, I'm actually excited about this project. I have an email address, which is caroline@torodi.net. So it's Caroline at Torodi, Torodey.net. So Torodi is a bit of a nickname that people give me. So, it's a bit of an Australian thing.
Well, on that bombshell, I will say thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth, performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS2195. Until next time.